The word breakthrough is bandied around a lot in the medical world, but it's fair to say it's a pretty accurate description of IVF. Along with surrogacy, IVF has brought thousands of babies into the world that otherwise would never have been born. Both practices have been around for some time now, but they still raise ethical questions and debate. The National Health and Medical Research Council, the NHMRC, is drafting new guidelines now about assisted reproductive technologies, looking specifically at whether women should be compensated for donating their eggs and whether couples using IVF should be allowed to select the gender of their child. That's two of the big issues in these draft guidelines. The council says the new guidelines are in response to a shift in community sentiment regarding IVF and these particular debates, and the dramatic increase too in the number of Australian couples heading overseas for commercial surrogacy arrangements. Jenny Milbank is a fertility law specialist at the University of Technology in Sydney. She's currently recruiting couples for a study on people who've gone overseas for fertility reasons. She joins me in the breakfast studio. Jenny, hello there.
Good morning.
And we're also joined by Liz Bishop, a lecturer in health and ethics at the Michael Kirby Centre for Public Health and Human Rights at Monash University in Melbourne. Liz, hello, welcome to you.
Hi, Fran.
Jenny, start with you. The NHMRC says these proposed guidelines are being put together to reflect changes in technology, but also in community attitudes towards IVF and surrogacy. Tell us about what you think are a change in community attitudes, and do the numbers tell us? What do they tell us when it comes to surrogacy, for instance? How many people from Australia are travelling overseas because they can't get donor eggs here?
Look, our estimates are based for surrogacy on applications for citizenship by descent, and what we've seen is a very rapid increase over the last 5 years. So, for instance, with children born in India, we saw the numbers of children born in India tripling in 5 years. My estimates would be at least 300 babies a year are born to Australians abroad in surrogacy. And I think we would have to have at least comparable numbers of Australian women going abroad for egg donation for babies that they come back and have in Australia themselves and register as their own child.
So you can get donor eggs overseas as well. It's not just a surrogate.
That's right. Women are travelling to Thailand, to South Africa, to Greece and to Spain, because waiting lists here for clinics are up to 5 years for a donor egg.
And what sort of price are people paying? We've heard a fair bit about surrogacy, but what sort of price is someone paying for a donor egg overseas?
Look, that's one of the important questions. And now that we have increases in egg vitrification technology, so now eggs themselves can be frozen and transported, we have eggs being imported into Australia. So if you import an egg into Australia, which is lawful to do if it complies with all of the Australian regulations and get treated here, that's $20,000, not for your treatment, just for the eggs. That makes travelling to Greece for donor eggs look pretty affordable.
So hang on, the $20,000 is to purchase the egg overseas or to purchase it and then all the regulation around bringing it back?
It's not purchase, indeed. It is accepted as reasonable expenses because that's what's permissible under Australian law.
But I mean, so it goes to the egg donor?
No. Less than $3,000 goes to the egg donor and $17,000 goes to the clinicians, to the transport, to the storage, to all the middle people.
That's a lot of money, isn't it? You are, Liz, I'll come to you in just a second, but just to stay with Jenny for a moment on this notion of donor eggs, because you are, I think, part of your contribution to this draft guideline discussion will be the notion of an egg bank. Is that right, a donor egg bank, like paying for eggs here in Australia?
Well, it's more complex than that. It's basically saying if we accept that infertility is an important issue of public health, then we should be committing public resources to that. So there should be a state role in donor recruitment and support. We should be looking at what donors need. Compensation is a very small part of that, and it shouldn't be an inducement. It shouldn't be something that makes poorer women undertake a practice that's not acceptable to them, but it should be enough to recognise the burden and the risk that egg donors and surrogates in particular are undertaking. That's a much more significant burden than sperm donors undertake when they donate, or blood donors, or indeed bone marrow donors.
So it's different to going to a sperm bank and getting, what, $100 or whatever.
That's right. You're taking fertility drugs, you're putting your body at risk, you're undergoing a surgical procedure to retrieve them. And the evidence from the UK is that the reason that they moved away from the kind of reimbursement of expenses model that we have is that the research on donors was that they felt really embarrassed turning up to the clinic to the receptionist with their parking receipts and asking for their $35 or whatever. So it's about setting a very modest set amount of compensation.
Like that, what?
I don't have a dollar figure to hand, because I think what we need to do is to consult very carefully to make sure that it is a modest form of recognition that is not an improper inducement.
Okay. Liz, you've been listening to all that. Let's start with the question that Jenny raised there. If we accept fertility is an issue of public health, then it follows that the government or the society should be helping set up a system that facilitates fertility. What's your response to that? Do you think fertility is an issue of public health?
In no way would say that it's not an issue of public health. My concern in the whole discussion is generally based on the fact that we start this discussion with fertility is the issue of public health. We move from that forward and we make a range of decisions, whether it's the egg sharing schemes, whether it's other egg donation banks, whether it's commercial surrogacy. We start with the position that we are looking at this from the perspective of those parents who want to be parents and can't mm-hmm. for reasons of fertility. And my perspective on this is that that's the wrong way to frame our discussion and the wrong way to enter into this great debate. And
What's the right way, Liz?
Centre is from the perspective of the child who will be born as a result of whichever of these fertility treatments is used.
And if we looked at this issue that we've just been discussing, the notion of donor eggs and perhaps having a donor egg system here in Australia where the egg donor is paid, it's a sort of regulated payment, it's not a life-changing sum of money like it, you know, would attract poor people to do it to get them a better life, it's something different to that. How does that look from the perspective of the child as you see it?
Well, can I go back one step
from
the perspective of the child? I have done a lot of research, looking into the research around those egg sharing schemes in the UK, and I've read a lot of reports around this. And it's not necessarily money that is the only key here, and that is not necessarily the key to, I think, the exploitation that's going on in this area over there. And researchers have found that even though women who entered into these schemes refuted that there were claims of exploitation, they said their decisions were freely made. Mm. They cited the fact that there was going to be beneficial future use of their eggs and that they were getting something in return, perhaps. At the time, they might have said that they didn't feel they were exploited, but when you look at their comments, they talked about the fact that they were in a state of baby madness, that they were so desperate to have a child. So there are different things that can render a woman vulnerable. And a lot of the comments come back saying, if I look at it now, I see it was exploitative, really, because I was going to have a child of mine out there in the world. They're preying on people, but I'm quite happy to be preyed upon to get the treatment. They're the kinds of comments that are made. So the exploitation is not necessarily only around the financial.
I'll just get Jenny's response, and then I'll come back to you about the from the child perspective too.
Sure.
They're two very important points. I think the egg sharing schemes it's something that we haven't done in Australia. I disagree about the British research. My reading of that research is that overwhelmingly women have said that they found that a beneficial practice. And the interesting thing about Girton's study at the London Women's Clinic was that they found that the socioeconomic and educational backgrounds of the donors and recipients were very similar. They were basically the same woman 10 years apart. So it was younger women going through treatment that was subsidised by them providing eggs to an older woman who was very much the same kind of woman as her, more lesbians than heterosexual women with donors. And they came out of that experience saying, I feel so grateful that I could have more opportunities to have my child and be able to have my child through an egg-sharing scheme. And they actually expressed the principle of solidarity quite strongly, that they saw this woman as their egg-sharing partner, they wished her well, and even women who one would say are the most vulnerable women in that exchange, and that is women who are unsuccessful in their own IVF treatment and have provided their eggs to another woman. Even those women said they were glad they'd done it.
So if that language, egg sharing rather than egg donor, changes the whole sort of feel of it. But as you said too, though, Jenny, it's quite an arduous medical procedure, isn't it? There's a lot of drugs involved.
That's right. And there is an argument that it is more ethical for women who are already undergoing that process to share or donate their eggs than healthy women in the general population putting themselves at risk through undergoing an IVF process that would not be otherwise undertaken for their own health.
Liz, there's a lot of tendrils here, and Jenny's there. Jenny's interpreted the British research differently to you have. What about the notion of, going back to your concern about the rights of the child here, I think you're opposed to the notion of commercial surrogacy, and we haven't really discussed that so much, but paying for donor eggs. You describe it as almost a type of human trafficking, don't you?
Well, if we're talking about commercial surrogacy, I think the international legal framework is very clear that if you transfer parentage of a child for value, that is trafficking. And there are a number of ways of debating this, but there are definitely children's international human rights experts who would agree that that is the case. But if we go back to the discussion about the use of egg donor schemes, yeah, or commercial surrogacy, I think that one of the fundamental problems with this is that it changes a child from being of intrinsic value to being of instrumental value, and it perpetuates this notion that the child is somehow being used as a means to the parents, the prospective parents' ends, and that they want to have their family. And so this using of a person who is going to be created for the ends of another, unless a person can consent to that, and a child in these circumstances obviously cannot consent, then I believe that that changes the notion of that child and the dignity of that child from being of intrinsic value to being of instrumental value. And I think that's at the heart of the problem.
Jenny, I mean, Liz's point is right, really, by and large. It is a selfish act, isn't it? People want to have children for their own benefit.
Fertile people too.
Of course.
Children's
not a rights thing.
It's a want. And I think children's interests and needs are incredibly important in this discussion, and I want to address them. But I do think that starting from kind of abstract universal principles is unhelpful, because parents have children.
Like the rights of the child?
Well, expressing the rights of a child as in terms of instrumentalism or need or whatever. Parents have kids because they want kids. Mm. Parents have kids however they can. Some people do it through sex. Some people do it through home insemination. Some people do it through a relationship with someone they don't really like very much. Some people do it with a parent who is their partner, who stays with them and raises that child for their life. Whatever. People do whatever they need to do to have a child.
Yeah.
Our role in crafting state regulation is to try to help people to make choices that the evidence tells us are beneficial choices for themselves, for their children, and to try to avoid situations where harmful practices are conducted. The interests of children, I think, are well served by our current regime, and domestic law, which provides, for example, for children to have access to information about their donors and information about their surrogates later on in life, is incredibly important. Parents are very cognizant in the studies that their children may have those needs later in life, but they're still going abroad and undertaking those practices in anonymous regimes where they're never going to have access to that information. And they're doing that because they feel they have no other choice.
And Liz, and we'll make this the end of this discussion, because I want to move on to the notion of gender selection, which is also covered in these draft guidelines. But Liz, that's true, isn't it? People are going to great lengths. They're going overseas. They're using anonymous donors, surrogates who are in another country who their child will never get to see or know again, probably, to do this. Is that an argument for changing the law to bring it back here, commercial surrogacy?
Well, what surrogacy, I think they're called Surrogacy Australia's own research has found that where there's an option to use surrogacy within Australia or overseas, that many people are actually choosing to go overseas for reasons that are not linked only to financial, but also to the fact that they would prefer to have a distance between themselves and the surrogate mother. So that to me is at the heart of what the problem here is, that when you creating systems in order to create children. And yes, I agree that, you know, that the desire to have a family is shared across the community, but we have an added responsibility here to ensure that those children know more than just a little bit of information about their genetics, but fulfill the right to actually have a relationship with those people that are part their parents. And we have found from the research that very rarely, beyond the first sort of 6 months period of post the baby being born, do surrogate mothers, particularly commercial surrogate mothers, have an opportunity to have that relationship with the child.
You're listening to RN Breakfast. It's 20 past eight. Our guests today with us, Jenny Milbank, fertility law specialist at the University of Technology of Sydney, and Liz Bishop, a lecturer in health and ethics at the Michael Kirby Centre for Public Health and Human Rights at Monash University. And we're looking at the draft guidelines that have been published by the NHMRC. There's a public discussion going on now about some of these issues. Another one of the elements covered by the draft guidelines is the option to gender select IVF babies. Jenny, I think this is something you support. It's possible now, with some medical issues where that's concerned. What sort of thing makes it possible now, and why do you support broadening it?
Look, again, the guidelines have said for some time that if there's a serious medical condition, and they leave that pretty open to the judgment of the clinicians, that sex selection can take place. We've seen sex selection from the earliest days in New South Wales for things like the BRCA gene, where women have said...
The breast cancer gene?
Women have said, I've got breast cancer in my family, I can't face it. But we also have seen one of the major clinics in New South Wales, which supported sex selection for so-called social reasons for family balancing, where people have got three boys and they want a girl, whatever. One of those large clinics set up a branch in Thailand and sent hundreds of their patients there, and that was okay. And again, you've got to say, if all of these people are going somewhere else, they're being treated by Australian doctors, what does it say about community attitudes? You haven't abstract principle that sex selection for social reasons is wrong, and then you have individual cases of people saying, I've got three boys and I want a girl.
So I guess what does that say about community attitudes in Australia, that that's what people are thinking? Liz, I know you feel you have a view on this, and you've got a personal take on this notion of gender selection, haven't you?
I do, actually. And again, it comes from the perspective of the child. I've been in a position myself where I was offered sex selection. I had a son with severe haemophilia who had actually, when I was pregnant, I actually spent about 6 months in the hospital with, in and out of ICU. So I understand that it can have a significant impact on the child. But I equally felt that if I went through sex selection in order to have a child who was not a boy because of the haemophilia gene, that that was somehow saying something to the child I already had that I wasn't prepared to say. And I feel like it's the beginning of a very slippery slope when the argument that it's happening elsewhere, so we should just make sure we happen in Australia and do it properly, is a very compelling argument. However, in some things there ought to be an ethical stance taken, I believe, that there are some standards that ought not to be acceptable. And
what I think is wonderful about that story is that that was your decision as a mother and a patient to make for yourself.
We're going to have to leave it there. Jenny Milbank, Liz Bishop, I really thank you both for joining us. This is such a personal debate, but it's such a sort of a deeply held and complex debate, isn't it? And it's going on now as part of the NHMRC process into the draft guidelines which have been published. They're open for public discussion now. If you want to be a part of it, head to the website of the NHMRC. Jenny Milbank is fertility law specialist at the University of Technology in Sydney. Liz Bishop, a lecturer in health and ethics at the Michael Kirby Centre for Public Health and Human Rights at Monash University. Thank you both of you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
And as we mentioned, Jenny Milbank is currently researching couples who've gone overseas for fertility treatments. She's looking for couples to take part in the project. If you want to know more, head to www.regulatingrelations.com.